This is Radio Eco Shop with your host, Alex Smith.
Right now, global corporations and scientists are plotting a coup against the natural order of things. They want to control the weather, the sky, the food you eat, maybe even the design of your body someday. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Diana Bronson is the program manager for an international organization called the Etc. Group, with offices in Canada, the U.S., Mexico, and the Philippines. Their latest book is Earth Grab, Geopiracy, the New Biomasters, and Capturing Climate Genes. Haven't heard about that? We'll also talk about synthetic biology, geoengineering, and other risky projects your mother never told you about. Diana Bronson, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's my pleasure.
We've already mentioned a shopping list of new trends flying under the public radar. Let's work our way down the list, maybe starting with capturing climate genes. What is that about?
Well, this is really trying to manufacture plants and crops that will withstand the stresses of climate change so that, for example, they're drought resistant or saline resistant or can withstand extreme temperatures. And, of course, plants can slowly evolve and adapt to climate change to a certain degree. But what we're talking about here is really technological interventions that are largely sponsored by the largest agricultural, food, and forestry firms in the world. What we discovered in this report, which is the third of the three that are published in the book Earth Grab by Pambazuka Press, is that a handful of multinational corporations have patented a whole series of multi-genome sequences that essentially amounts to taking proprietary control over those sequences in order to be able to manipulate them and then sell them back to farmers at a profit. So we found there's 262 patent families, they're called. Those are patents of the same nature, but there's 262 different ones that were claimed by six multinational corporations and their smaller partners between 2008 and 2010. What we're saying that shows is that the capacity to adapt to climate change is no longer going to be left in the hands of governments and the representatives of people and local communities who are going to need to develop new ways of farming and develop new traits within plants. It'll, in fact, be owned by multinational corporations like Monsanto and Bayer and BASF and Syngenta. And so that's really a very worrying tendency, and we don't see why, if climate change is the emergency that the entire world seems to agree that it is, why we would allow private corporations to control such technologies.
So if we had horrible climate change, we'd have to buy our new agricultural plants from them.
Well, there would be a big push to do that. You know, there's a number of very influential organizations and corporations and northern governments and private foundations who are saying that we've got to up food production to meet the growing population, expected to be 9 billion people by 2050. We've got to intensify agricultural production and so on, and that we're going to need these technologies and these corporations to do that. We actually think it's quite the contrary that needs to be done. We need to put food production back into the hands of small-scale farmers and create policy environments that is favorable to them. And that'll not only improve food security, but it will improve climate resilience. We explain that in quite some detail in a report called Who Will Feed Us? That you can get on etcetragroup.org's website. That's not in the Earth Grab book, although many of the statistics and the analysis is present in the report called Capturing Climate Genes.
So your book, Earth Grab, also has a report on the new biomasters, and the emphasis here is on biomass. What is going on that we need to be concerned about?
Yeah, it's a little bit like the story around biofuels gone wild. I mean, what happened when Western governments started to massively subsidize biofuels, subsidies that are still going on to this day, is that it threw the world into an even worse food crisis than it already was. As you may or may not know, or as listeners may or may not know, about 1 billion people in the world today don't have enough to eat. And even the initial steps of corn ethanol threw an estimated 170 million people into hunger. And the problem is, in a broad general sense, is that we're imagining all kinds of new uses for biomass, which is just a name for undifferentiated living stuff. You know, rather than having plants and trees and growth and all of these different types of biodiverse living organisms, it's all just lumped together as biomass and commodified as such. There's a whole series of uses that are being imagined for this. It's going to provide fuel, it's going to provide food, it's going to provide energy, all of these things. And basically the problem is that 80% of the world's biomass is located in the tropical and subtropical regions. Where it has not been commodified, people are living on it. And for the most part, those people are living fairly sustainable lives compared to the kind of lives that we live in the north. And when we contemplate all these new uses for this biomass, corporations get very interested, wealthy governments get very interested, and land begins to get bought up. And that has become a fairly well-known phenomenon called the land grab, which the non-governmental organization GRAIN did a great deal to expose back in 2008. And as increasingly alternatives are sought to the fossil fuel economy, rather than looking at small-scale, local, adaptable solutions for renewable energy, we're looking for the next big thing. And there you will find also that it's the very same oil and chemical companies who have been involved in the fossil fuel industry who are actually involved in the new biomass economy. So, you know, BP, for instance, is there, and they're all partnering with these smaller firms, many of whom are involved in a technology called synthetic biology. And perhaps just to say a few words about what synthetic biology is, it's a form of extreme genetic engineering. Well, as traditionally GM crops, what they do is they take a gene sequence from one crop and they put it into another crop in order to develop a certain trait. Well, synthetic biology actually attempts to build living materials from scratch and create entirely synthetic organisms that have no natural equivalent. So when you start looking at these technologies and the impacts that they could have, it can become very serious indeed. For example, let's talk about algae. Very often you'll read in the newspaper that, you know, algae is going to be the next clean fuel. Well, we need to think about, well, where is that algae going to be grown? And it's true that algae does suck down carbon dioxide. It consumes carbon dioxide. That's how it grows. But are we going to have synthetic algae grown in open ponds that can then be released into the broader environment and sort of act like an invasive species does when a species from one part of the world is artificially transported to another? And how will that affect natural ecosystems? And will it even work? You know, that's another whole question. We know, for example, in the case of corn ethanol, that when you do a full life cycle analysis of that biofuel, the greenhouse gas emissions are just as high as fossil fuels because of the energy that went into the inputs and the transportation and so on, not to mention the way it threatens food security. You know, what we're saying about biomass is let's just be very, very cautious about lumping things together as biomass and assuming there's endless amounts of it that can be appropriated and generated into various products from plastic to fuel to all these other things that will allow us to keep on living the lifestyles that we live.
I've got to tell you, you're giving me the shivers here. We're going to take everything that grows, everything that's green, and we're going to grind it up in the machine to get stuff out for ourselves. And then maybe we'll release some sort of new goo that could take over the oceans. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our last short interview with Pat Mooney of the Etc. Group was in 2007. That story, called Don't Geoengineer the Oceans, has been downloaded over 10,000 times from our website. There's lots of interest. Diana, maybe you could begin by defining geoengineering.
Yeah, geoengineering is the large-scale technological manipulation of the Earth's systems, and usually these days it's discussed in reference to climate change as a so-called solution to climate change.
And what are some of the new technologies being suggested to cool off an overheated planet?
Well, for example, the sort of top technology that's being discussed in scientific and policy circles, mostly in the UK and the United States, but also in Canada and Germany and Australia and other countries, is known as stratospheric aerosols. And the idea there is that you're going to pump small particles of sulfur dioxide or possibly of other chemicals into the upper layer of the Earth's atmosphere, the stratosphere, about 25 kilometers off the surface of the Earth, in order to reflect a portion of the sunlight back to outer space. They call this solar radiation management. Another technology, as you referred to earlier, is ocean fertilization. That would be dumping iron particles or nitrogen into the ocean in order to provoke the growth of algae once again to suck up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and then sink it to the bottom of the ocean. This is very much discredited in scientific circles, but nonetheless, there's corporations and some scientists who continue to want to explore this idea as a solution to global warming. You can get a much better idea of all the technologies. There's about 30 of them, I would say, depending on how you classify them, in the overview that's provided in EarthGrab or off our website from Geopiracy, the case against geoengineering. There's a full listing and a critique of some of them and a more detailed critique of some of them, as well as an analysis of who is behind these technologies, particularly from the scientific milieu, but also from governments and corporations. I'd say that corporations aren't yet into geoengineering in a big way. It's still too high risk for them, and it would do a great deal of damage if they were out front on this issue. But nevertheless, for example, Bill Gates has been investing in this area. He's got major investments into a carbon dioxide removal technology that's being developed by David Keith in Calgary. Richard Branson has been involved with his carbon war room. So, you know, there are well-known industrialists who are involved. But for the most part, it's been a kind of scientific lobby along with some very strong supporters within the UK and US governments.
Well, now, Diana, as you know, greenhouse gas emissions just hit another record in 2010. There's no end in sight. Some scientists and governments say we need to have geoengineering in our toolbox in case there's a sudden and abrupt climate change. Maybe we'll thank them then. How do you reply to that argument?
Well, there's several things. I think the risks are far greater in deploying these technologies. For example, if you talk about stratospheric aerosols, assuming that it would actually work, which is a large assumption, a very generous assumption, once you started doing it, you could never stop. And then the other thing is that this reduces the willingness of governments to invest in mitigation. Already we're dealing with very, very low levels of political will, and we need to turn that around. And I don't think the way to turn that around is to say, we've got a technological fix, that if we throw, you know, a few billion dollars at research, you know, it may work one day. Well, what if it doesn't? I mean, ultimately, there's no long-term solution for the problem of climate change that does not involve changing the ways in which we live. So it's rather hubristic, to say the least, that we'd put all our money in that technology, speculative technology basket, rather than doing things like invest in public transportation, develop agroecological farming systems that would reduce the ecological footprint of industrial farming, that would better feed the world as well. There's so many other solutions that we can provide for global warming that do not involve this level of risk. And then the other thing about it is it's incredibly inequitable in terms of a north-south dynamic. The northern governments that are involved and the northern scientists that are involved and who are dominating this discussion, you know, talk about, oh, well, perhaps the G8 or perhaps the G20 or perhaps a coalition of the willing or perhaps a small coalition of countries with scientific capabilities will get together, will write the rules. And what we've been saying is that that's completely unacceptable, that there's no way this should go ahead. It needs to be discussed at the United Nations, and every country has something to say about that. And I think, you know, last year at the Convention on Biological Diversity, we won a moratorium on these technologies. That's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it just put a little bit the brakes on. We need to strengthen that moratorium. We need to change it into a firm ban on any kind of experimentation of geoengineering technologies that do not have international consent and authority. There's no way that one country or a small group of countries or even one scientist or one corporation should be allowed to, you know, undertake the manipulation of the climate on behalf of the rest of us. And right now, it's a bit of a free-for-all.
Right. That's such a scary prospect. It could be a billionaire or just a country like Russia or any country could say, well, you know, it's too hot for us, so we're going to send this stuff up into the stratosphere and block off the sunlight for everybody. And I wonder what happens if you block incoming sunlight, what happens to agricultural production and the wild plants and the animals?
Yeah, and the precipitation patterns and solar power. And in fact, it, you know, you stop having blue skies. There's a great article that was written about this by Alan Robach called 20 Reasons Why Geoengineering May Be a Bad Idea. And if you go to his website, you'll be able to see a couple of updates on the article. But there's many, many reasons why this kind of geoengineering is a bad idea. It's also, you know, basically it's been an accepted principle of international law that we employ the precautionary principle on these kinds of things. And when there's such uncertainty on what the impacts could be, we should not be going ahead.
Okay, well, there is pushback from civil organizations, including your own etc. group. Who are some of the key voices and institutions we should be searching out in defense of the natural world?
Well, there's many. I mean, one thing that people can do is go to a campaign website. It's called handsoffmotherearth.org, and you can actually send in your photo and signify your opposition to these kinds of technologies there. Of course, there's many, many organizations, environmental and social organizations, and you'll see many of them, in fact, on that website who've signed up to that website, who we work, such as Friends of the Earth, Third World Network, La Via Campesina, and many, many more, who have been active on this issue. So that's probably a good place to start, and then you could go and visit any of the other organizations that are listed there. Of course, organizations like Greenpeace are also following this. It's just really important that we look at both the environmental and social impacts of these technologies. And right now, internationally, we have no mechanism for doing that. It's very interesting. You know, we're headed into the Rio Plus 20 conference. It's the 20th anniversary of the Earth Summit that took place in Brazil in 1992. And one of the things that was agreed to 20 years ago was the world needed some means to assess technologies before they were deployed around the globe. That's in Chapter 34 of Agenda 21, if anybody cares to look it up. But that was never done. So we've also got a major push on to try and get technology assessment incorporated into the Rio Plus 20 process that'll take place next June. And the negotiations for that are ongoing. The first draft of that statement is expected in January. And we're pushing very hard with many, many other organizations to have some kind of technology assessment adopted.
Well, tell us how we can find the Etc. Group and your new book, Earth Grab.
Okay, well, Etc. Group, you can find us online at etcgroup.org. You can find many, many reports on our website, including those that are in Earth Grab. In fact, Earth Grab has the most updated versions of those reports, and you can get it from Pambazuka Press. Pambazuka Press is an African publisher, and they've undertaken to publish these reports because they think that what we have to say, I guess, is highly relevant for Africa. And you can buy a copy of Earth Grab on their website, Pambazuka. I think it's pambazuka.org. Earth Grab, published by Pambazuka Press.
I'll put a link in my blog at ecoshock.info. People can find it. As we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, I just, once again, really encourage people to get involved and get informed and pressure their governments and write about it in their media and find out more about it by getting more information and perhaps sending in their photo to signify their opposition to these technologies at handsoffmotherearth.org.
You've been listening to Diana Bronson from the Etc. Group. We've been talking about new and dangerous developments at the fringe of industrialized science. Find out more at www.etcgroup.org. Thank you, Diana.
Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.